When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, this is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
There she is.
I forgot to start the stopwatch timer and I got confused.
My daughter is on the other side of this podcast, on the other side of the Atlantic. Not sort of, she's completely on the other side of the Atlantic. Over in Zurich
and I'm in Atlanta.
Plus some landmass. And we saw each other in Iceland this summer, which was really fun.
We did, you know, and I kept promising to all of our listeners that we would talk about that trip, and we sort of like never really did. And we've also been moving towards penny stocks, so should we?
Well, can I tell everybody that you got naked and jumped into the fjord? You went into the fjord where your great-great-great-grandfather fished from the time he was 14, fished for sharks, hunted sharks.
I thought he was my great-great. I think he's my great-great and he's your great. Yeah.
Okay, he's my great. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he was
born
in
like
1840s.
Context to this. So as everybody knows, I've been massively ill for a long time. And so we planned this trip with me knowing that it was going to be a huge stretch for me. And so we were very careful to like not plan much stuff. Right. But we just wanted to go and go to the National Archive and see the records of our family. And I had been to Iceland before and done that, but you and my sister hadn't. So we just wanted to do that. And we thought we would stay in Reykjavik the whole time because that was the easiest place to fly into. But the family is actually from the north of Iceland, which is like either a long drive or a flight to get to. So we had decided, okay, that's too bad, but we're just not going to go up there because it's going to be too much for me. And we also were only going to be there for a long weekend. So I've been doing like various things and been getting a little more normalcy, maybe. I don't know exactly.
Robust.
Some days are very much less than normal. Some days are a little more robust. Yeah. But the coolest thing was that I got there, like usually a flight would have just destroyed me. And I got there and I was like, I am not destroyed. This is the best thing ever. And we had the best time our first day and we went to the National Archive right as they were closing and they were so nice to us and let us like look for the books and we started
The first thing we did was get in a cab coming back from the airport and have the cab driver tell us that we were related because there's
this app. Oh yeah, I forgot about that because you were so excited.
I'm so excited. There's an app that everyone uses in Iceland to be sure you're not about to marry your cousin because there's like 380,000 people or something. So
yeah.
And everybody whose family have been there from the beginning are all related in some way or another. And this app shows you if you are. And in a matter of a minute, knowing our great-great-grandfather's birth date and location, he found him and then went back from there and found that we were related from his ancestor to our ancestor. We're brothers back in 1590. They were born in 1590. And it's like, okay, this is really amazing. We're in an interesting country that has really, really good records of everyone going back to the founders.
Yeah.
So well, yeah, really quite cool.
So for people who don't know about Iceland genealogy, it's been such an isolated island for almost 1,000 years, right? Like since roughly like 1400, I think they're 1200.
No, 890.
There were people coming in and out for a little while, and then there was kind of a period where people stopped moving to Iceland, essentially. And mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly when that was. But so for very many hundreds of years, it's been isolated and cut off. And like you said, like everybody had to just sort of marry each other. And
yeah.
So it also is a place where in the Nordic tradition, they don't have last names. You take the name of your father's first name and add son or daughter to it.
Right.
And women don't change their names when they got married. They're just so-and-so's daughter for their whole lives. And so in order to track who was married to who and who was whose child, the church parishes took excellent records of everybody. And so because Iceland was one, so isolated, and two, had very reliable genealogical records of who and when and where everybody was born and got married and died, it has the best genealogical records in the world. And because of that, like, we as descendants of Icelanders can go to the National Archives and actually look at the actual books of these church parish records.
Yeah, it's just incredible. The original books. It was like they just pull them out and give them to you. It's like, here you go.
They do have copies now. But when I went before, like 10 years ago, they didn't have copies then. She said they were in the process of starting to put it all onto,
amazing,
you know, microfiche or whatever.
So now there's this archivist app.
Yeah. And there's an app, because now, like, with everybody doing online dating, the first thing you do is like pull out the app and make sure you're not too closely related. And it's kind of mostly a joke, but also kind of cool.
Yeah, pretty cool. And so we went there the first day and found the records of my great grandfather, who's John Thordarson. We found his birth record. So now we knew pretty much where, what parish he was born in and what day, you know, what day he was born on. Mm-hmm. And that gave us information that we didn't have. We had Rosa's stuff. They got married and came to Canada, immigrated out of Iceland when there was this huge famine going on in the 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
They immigrated to Canada. And then after several years of trying to make it there, they came down and homesteaded in North Dakota, failed on their first homestead, moved another 20 miles south. So they were about 30 miles from the Canadian border in a really tough country.
And wasn't it wild how pretty much everybody who we told, oh, your great-grandparents emigrated in the 1800s, they immediately said, was it to Winnipeg? Because there was, everybody went.
Yeah.
To Winnipeg. Like, I didn't realize that. I just kind of imagined sort of like boats going to different destinations for whatever reason. But no, they all went to Winnipeg.
And
so that there's
tough.
A huge Icelandic group still there.
Oh, yeah, it must be, right? And they tried to have an Icelandic settlement just, I believe, just north of Winnipeg. And John went up there for a season, for a winter season. And Rosa's notes were like, she was sort of like mad at him. Because he didn't come back with any money. He came back with $10.
Well, yeah. Oh,
cutting
crappy.
Wood up there and didn't like it. So they finally were successful with a homestead. And then part of the reason for that was that John started working in the lumber industry, which he'd had some experience with in Canada, and started to make a living and built a nice house and then got into the grain industry and was a grain broker. Then basically he died of cancer and Rosa immigrated to Oregon, where my grandmother was raised. And actually she was raised in North Dakota until she was about 17 and or 20 rather. And then she and Rosa went together with her sister, one of her sisters, and they homesteaded about 500 acres in Willamette Valley and couldn't make it because John died of cancer. And then they went into the city in Portland, met my grandfather. She got married, and here we are.
Rosa met your grandfather. Yeah.
Christine.
Sorry. Yeah, of course, not Rosa.
and then
I get them all mixed up.
Christine was weakened by giving birth. Well, she gave birth to four boys. My dad, your grandfather, was the fourth one. And she was so weak after giving birth to him, she died 2 months later.
It's so sad. Some
version of the flu or something, and then she was gone. So my dad never knew her. Of course, we never knew her. But we knew this Icelandic background, right? My dad's half Icelandic.
And it's been such family lore for such a long time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We really wanted to check it out. Had no idea how cool it was going to be, honestly, though.
Really?
Yeah, well, when we tracked down
John's
parish.
The funniest thing to me about the whole trip was how surprised you were at how cool it was.
Oh, my gosh.
Because when
surprised.
I went there the first time, I was just expecting it to be totally awesome, and it totally was. And I think, I don't know, maybe
I just hadn't thought about it too much. I just didn't really have any expectation of how it hit me.
Yeah.
But when we got a hold of a guide, just happenstance on the internet, just dug in and found a guide who was available named Thor Helmerson. And Thor had lived his whole life up in Akureyri. And
wait. Let's, before we get to Thor. Mm. So the way that we met Thor is that on that day, the first day we arrived and we went to the Blue Lagoon, which is amazing. And I totally recommend it. And, and by the way, I think that actually, not just besides that the Blue Lagoon is incredible, but I feel like for the three of us, it was a very impressionable moment of thinking about how unbelievably hard Rosa and John's lives were. And we spent that whole time there talking about them. Do you remember? Like in the pools
and
stuff.
In the lap of luxury.
In the absolute lap of luxury that we were in. Mm-hmm. In, you know, just, it doesn't get better than that. We were in like the top tier of the top tier section of the Blue. It was so wonderful.
Yeah.
And we just spent the whole time just going like, this is like literally nobody in our family had really, except for me that one time, but I didn't really do the family stuff too much. So nobody in her family had come back to Iceland since they left on that boat to go to Winnipeg and become homesteaders and do everything else they did.
150 years.
And we fly in and go to this freaking Blue Lagoon like spa experience
in the middle of a gigantic lava field.
Unbelievable dichotomy of experiences, and we felt it. That was I think actually looking back, I think maybe if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't have even had quite the same like intense experience. I don't know.
I hadn't thought of it like that. That's my.
I hadn't
really
either until I was thinking about that day just now. And so we did the Blue Lagoon like most of the day from the morning into the afternoon. And then we got back and I said, you know, I think maybe I could do the trip up north to Akureyri because I was feeling strong. And the flight over there hadn't given me fatigue. So you really made it happen. Like you guys just booked things and you found Thor on the internet somehow. And we got plane tickets for the next morning at 7 a.m. to fly the 1 hour flight up to Akureyri. And we just like did it. And it was unbelievable. It was the most massive day, exhausting, incredible day. Yeah. So we landed in Akureyri. Thor, who we had no clue about, picked us up at the airport. Turns out he's like the loveliest Icelandic man guide. Like everybody book him if you go to Akureyri. How do you find him, Dad? Like, what was he under? Does he have a website?
He was just a guide working for some company. And
I know he said that he has an Instagram. This is the worst. I should look this stuff up.
Yeah, we should
look.
Get that,
I think it's under like Thor the Guide, something like that. And he's North Iceland. So if you find a Thor who's in Reykjavik, it's not him. It's only the Thor that's in Akureyri.
Yep.
And he picked us up and he was like, "Do you want to go to the waterfall? Because everybody wants to go to the waterfall." And we were just like, "No,
no.
Can you take us to an empty field that is roughly in this location, but we don't actually know where it is." Right. And he was kind of like, "What?" Like he was very nice about it, but he was definitely weirded out by us. And then we sort of explained and we drove and talked about the family stuff. And then he like got into it and he was like, "I'm going to call my sister, who's the head of like the Heritage Museum or something like that, and like see if she can look it up," because we knew, like Dad said, like roughly the county, but we didn't know
and
like
we knew
where
the name
in
of the farm.
Yeah, but we knew it in this very badly written, transliterated English.
Right.
Which is not spelled the same way the Icelanders spell it. So we were trying to say something and they would be like, I don't even know what you're saying because it's not a word that we have. And
like
so
it's pronounced something like Zvenarmus, something like that.
Zvenarmus.
Yeah. So you can imagine what somebody is writing down when you get that word. And Thor understood the parish, which was going to be north up the peninsula, and north and up the fjord out of Akureyri.
But that's Svinarnes. I mean, even before that, like, remember we stopped by that river and he was like, I think this is roughly the farm. And it was called whatever that first farm was called. And then we found the church where they would have gotten married.
That was Rosa's side of things.
Oh, okay.
That was Rosa's side. So we found the farm that Rosa was spent her life on from 6 years old until 26 years old.
Okay, yeah.
Found that farm and got
to
walk out
on it.
Which is, by
the way, that place was so beautiful.
Oh, my.
Every single one of these places, we were just like,
you could
build
a
$10 million home here and everyone would be like, yeah, that's correct.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah. The view is better than your $10 million home.
Oh, yeah. You're looking like the view. Here's what I did not expect. We lived 20 some years in Jackson Hole and this view was like that.
It was Jackson level. It absolutely was.
Gosh,
it was unbelievable.
Beautiful.
So
just
they were not.
This valley with beautiful farms and these big mountains rising up on both sides.
Yeah.
It was stunning. It really was.
It reminded me a lot, if anybody's been to Yellowstone, it reminded me a lot of the Lamar Valley. It was like just this very long valley and the mountains on both sides. And you could see, and a big river, and you could see the whole valley from like various vantage points. It was just super cool.
And everywhere you look on the valley on the sides was some amazing peak. It was just like your view was cut off by peaks in all directions. It was.
And we got
so
lucky because the clouds went away. We wouldn't have seen any of it if it had been cloudy, which I'm sure most of the time it is cloudy. So we found these other places, and then Thor goes, so do you want to go to the waterfall now? And we were just like, no, we actually don't care about the waterfall. And he was like, everybody wants to go to the, and we could tell, like, he just wanted to give us a good day, you know, and do the tour guiding thing that he does. And finally, he just was like, he sort of clicked and was like, all right, I got it. Like, they don't want to go to the waterfall. They want to go see more dirt. And so I'm going to help them. And at that point,
He got into it. Oh my God.
He looked at all of our papers.
We wanted to see everything. We knew that
both
of their farms were on the east side of the river, and you have to cross the river to get to Akureyri.
Yeah.
And there were no bridges because we know that from the writings from back. And we wanted to know where would they cross this river. So we started exploring. Thank goodness he had a big four-wheel drive American beast of a car. What was that thing?
I don't know, a Suburban maybe?
Yeah, it was like it was a Ford something. It was a Ford Expedition, but bigger. And so we would get right down on the dirt roads and open gates and close gates.
Yes, yeah, so this is the...
Apparently that's completely legal in Ireland.
So this is
Iceland,
the next thing. So I was like showing him the piece of paper that had, so that was Rosa's stuff, like you said. And then John, who she married, had lived up the valley more closer to the ocean and where she was down like more in the protected fjord area. And so we were showing him this name and he goes, I don't know that name. It's just, I'm not familiar with it. And then he called another friend of his. Yeah, he said it doesn't translate. So he called a friend of his and then he came back and he goes, okay, I think I figured it out. I think it's up the fjord towards the ocean, but there's no road that goes there anymore. There used to be, like back when he would have lived there, they would have had some sort of road, but now it's like nobody uses it anymore. So there's no road. So the closest we can get is this town that's basically the end of the road. So we said, okay, cool. Let's just go to the town. And on the way, he said, I'll just stop at home and get this really good topo map and my amazing giant dog and put his amazing giant dog in the car and got his map. And he comes back with the map and he goes, the map actually shows that there's a dirt road that goes out there. So I think maybe we can do it. And he goes, I don't know how far we can get, but let's try. So we were like, done. Like, finally, we're going for it, and Thor's into it. So, yeah, drove the dirt road, ended up at the very end.
We get there, and it's blocked, of course.
It was?
With a fence. Yeah, there's a fence.
You had to open some fences. Yeah.
And it turns out that in Iceland, there's a law that you can go through anybody's property. And there's no such thing as trespassing in Iceland. And so Thor didn't have to ask permission from anybody. You just basically got to take care of the gates. So we just drove up, pulled open this kind of wire gate and opened the road. And we drove through, then we closed the gate.
There is trespassing, but there's no stopping right of way. He explained it like you're allowed to walk through.
Yeah. There it is. That's right. So now we find ourselves moving north up this peninsula that is completely rugged. There's no one that lives up there.
It was like Highway 1 on Big Sur if Highway 1 was a tiny one-lane dirt road.
Little dirt track.
But it was like that kind of like drop-off and incredible views.
Yeah, with the drop-off that goes down to the ocean, 1,000 feet down, and there's, you know, the road's kind of
eroded. And it's a mountain. Like, we weren't driving on the top. Like, we were driving on the side of the mountain. Oh, yeah. It was just amazing.
It's a cut trail into the side of this very steep mountain. And it went on for 7 kilometers of this, just working our way, not knowing how far we could get before we had to turn around, which is a euphemism because you couldn't turn around. There was no way to turn around on this thing. You'd have to back out this four-wheel drive road. It was like, interesting. And there were a couple places where it was so sketchy and eroded with the big drop-off that I was thinking of asking Thor to let us walk. And, you know, basically he would anticipate that and be on us. Okay, got it. We got
this. It was
this.
All right. I was sitting behind him on the driver's side, and I could see that it wasn't too sketchy on that side. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we kept coming to, oh, and it turns out that if you have certain maps, that the names of the farms are on those maps because the farm names stay with the farm.
That was wild.
And they stay with the farm from back hundreds of years. And so you'll see these dots on the map with a name, and it's the name of the farm, and it goes back forever. So
this map that he had was from last year, and it had the same name as the names that we had, Svínáres, from 1890.
Yeah, exactly.
Insane.
And we only had, and so we knew roughly where it was. It was a point on the map, so, you know, you don't know how accurate those are.
Yeah.
But we got a real benefit of some good markings from the country. Because these properties had sort of become landmarks of sort, like sort of historical, very rough to live up there on this fjord. It was very far from anything and very hard to get to town. And to this day, we don't know if our ancestors rode a boat to town or whether they tried to take a horse to town or a wagon to town or walk to town. It's like 20 miles down to Akureyri, there's the crow flies. So we got closer and we started to see some abandoned ruins. And so we stopped and got out and began to look in that direction. And there was a signpost that said the name of the farm that was right before Svínáres. And we were like, holy smokes. And it's got the date that there was an attempted homestead. And then
it was basically abandoned. A historical plaque.
Yeah, a little square about 6 inches on a post. And so then we knew right where we were. And it was right where the map said we were. So we could look and see the ruins of the farmhouse, which was on Svínáres. And then we kept going another kilometer or so or a little less and came to a really livable part of this fjord. It was not so steep. It was still steep, but not ridiculous. We could turn the truck around. And there it was, Svínáres sign by a ruin that had rock stone foundation. And then the ruin was cement, which meant that it had, of course, been built later. And John abandoned this place. The latest he used it was 1876. Mm-hmm. That was the year that they left. Unless his father was still there, which may be the case. We just don't know what happened to his dad, our great-great grandfather, because they were shark fishermen. And shark fishing was only allowed in the winter time, astonishingly, which meant that was because everyone had to work on a farm in the summertime all through that time period. It was sort of communal, tribal living. And so everyone went down to the more arable parts of Akureyri and worked farms. That's why John had a farm down there. And then in the winter, they would go up on this peninsula and they had a little alcove that you could get a boat into. So just
well,
why
that's
they chose
how we,
that.
That's, I think, how we really knew that we had found the right place.
Right.
Because we found that little inlet.
Place.
And it just made sense. That's
yep.
a place where you could come back with a shark dragging off the side of your literally rowboat, and you could get the shark up the rocks, and there were rocks that were kind of smoothed a little bit, mm-hmm. and either they started out that way or they got that way. And there was another ruin of a dwelling or of a drying house or of a process mm-hmm. something
mm-hmm.
That was there, so
yep.
we're 99% sure that's the spot. It was
yep.
pretty crazy to think about that life and try
yep.
to imagine it. And
oh, there was two things that made it possible to live there. One was you could get your boat away from the rough water of the fjord.
Yeah.
And the second was that there was a little tiny river, which is what this farm was named for.
Mm.
Svenarnes means, what does it mean? Pig something. And it's the Pig River.
Yeah, it was like the Pig Creek, something like
Pig Creek
that.
Or something. It was they call it a river, but it's, 4 feet wide. But it comes down like a waterfall in Yosemite off of this mountain and ran fairly near where they put the house foundation. So they could get fresh water and they could get their boat in. And those are the mm-hmm. two things they had to have in order to live there. Initially we thought, they had to bring sharks up onto this bluff, which would be tough work. And then we found out later that they didn't bring the sharks in unless they were going to bury them and eat them later, let them ferment for 3 or 4 months and become edible of sorts. Otherwise, they would gut the shark out at sea and pull the liver, and that's what they were hunting for.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah. So the livers were very, very valuable because it was oil that could be used in lamps. And they sold them to traders who took them to Denmark. Huh. And you could make a good living and you could buy farms if you survived. And of course, survival was the essence of understanding the winds and understanding your boat. I mean, these guys were going out in 20-foot rowboats that would have two or three sets of oars to row. It'd be like 6 or 7 guys on the boat. And John started going out with his dad when he was 14. That was the youngest you were allowed to go. And sometimes people just didn't come back and nobody ever knew what happened to them. And that was just the end of it. Because if your boat tipped over, most of these guys couldn't even swim. So much less survive in the Arctic Sea in the winter.
Right. Think about the modern clothing that fishermen wear.
Right.
The rain gear, the water gear, the survival gear. They didn't have any of that. They had wool, probably.
No, they had skins.
Oh, they would wear skins.
Yeah.
You must have learned all this stuff after I left.
I did. I learned it when we went up to one of the northern fjords. It wasn't Akureyri. And they have a display set out by the water.
Oh, and that's
water.
Where you got that photo.
That's where I got the photo of,
photo of
like
the painting.
A boat that was from 1936. So it was very much... It was built out of driftwood. All the forests were cut down in Iceland for survival.
Mm-hmm.
And the only wood that was available was driftwood coming in from Siberia. And so they would find this amazing driftwood, which would be fabulously sturdy, and carve it and build boats. And the oars were, I rode for years in the Grand Canyon. We had oars with blades that were about 8 inches wide. And these guys had blades that were about 3 inches wide. And that was because they were going to row for 8 or 9 hours. The doula who was describing all this. Isn't that a person that explains historic docent? Things? Docent.
Like
yeah,
in a museum?
Yeah, doula.
Oh, okay.
Else.
A doula is a birth coach. So I was a little confused. There we go. Okay.
So docent. So it wasn't in a museum. It was outdoors at a display of what the homes looked like and so on. And she wore a waterproof suit.
And what
it
cool.
was you take sheepskin, turn it inside out, and on the outside you cover it with fish oil and shark oil.
Uh-huh.
And it becomes impermeable of sorts. And that's what they wore. They wore hats made out of that and the whole thing all the way down to their feet.
Nice.
And get this,
bet that worked.
Oh, I think it worked really well, actually. And it may be even better than the gear we have now. Who knows?
It's probably really heavy, but I bet it kept the water out.
Yeah, I would think so. And weight wouldn't be a real problem in rowing. You're just trying to stay warm.
Yeah.
But one of the cool, cool things that they showed us was that they used a two-thumb glove.
Okay.
Like they would knit a two-thumb glove. It would be a glove on each side of the glove. I mean, a thumb on each side of the glove.
Uh-huh.
And the reason they did that is because when you're rowing, you know, you're going to wear out the inside, the part of the glove that's on your inside of your hand. And this will allow you to turn the glove over in another thumb hole there and then row it again. So the gloves would last twice as long.
Amazing.
So I thought those were really cool.
That is so smart.
But she was talking about how dangerous this was. I mean, so many of these guys lost their lives going out in the Arctic Sea.
Yeah.
In the winter to fish with big fish hooks to try to hook these Norwegian sharks that were bottom feeders mostly. And they would pull them up. They would be as big as the boat. 20 feet was common. And then they would, which means you've got a fighting shark on the other end of this thing while you're dealing with the sea. Yeah. So that was just breathtaking how tough these guys were to survive up there like that.
And that
the women,
land,
holy Christmas.
That land felt hard to live on.
Oh, yeah.
Well, so to get back to the beginning of what you said, so we were there and it's a hill because it was on a mountain. It's basically the bottom of a mountain. And I thought like, without getting into all my limitations, climbing up a hill is extremely difficult for me. And I thought if I go down there, I'm going to have to come back up. And you guys were like, you know what, we'll help you. Like, just it's worth it. And so I decided to just do it. And if I was dead the next day, fine. I was dead the next day. So went down there. I'm so glad I did. And we were just wandering around and feeling the atmosphere. And we both, Lena and I, were just like, we just got to jump in to commune with our ancestors. So Dad turned around, went back up the hill. And it was stripped off and we didn't jump in. It was horribly cold. It was exactly as cold as you imagine the Arctic Sea to be. So basically, individually, each one of us stood there and we're like, okay, do it. And then basically like went down into the water, got out as quick as we could. And then with great encouragement, the other one helped each of us up because it was super slippery and there was so much algae around.
Yeah.
And cracking our head open in Svinar Ness at the end of the world didn't sound like a great idea.
No.
We managed to do it safely. And honestly,
and
it did feel like something.
Right where the boat would come in.
Yeah.
You did it
in the beginning, I was like, oh, I shouldn't do it because it could make me more tired. And blah, blah, blah. And I just had this feeling like, no, I need, like, they want me to do this. I need to do this.
Oh, it's so cool.
So we did it and it was great.
Oh man, that's so cool.
And then we somehow got back up the hill and went back to the airport and flew back to Reykjavik and basically have been amazed that we did that ever since then.
Super, super great. I think just a lead, we were going to talk about penny stocks today and we sort of went off on this little mental journey, but there's something to learn here for investing. And that is that.
What's that, Dad?
We talk a lot about risk. And in penny stocks, one of the great cautions of penny stocks is they're much more risky than larger, more established companies. Often they're not very good companies and they're just struggling. And there are people who purport to be able to tell you what stocks to buy, and they're just old fashioned pump and dump schemes and scam artists. And I mean, the penny stock world is much less regulated and much more wild, wild west. And maybe not the best place for somebody that wants to buy and hold something forever, because these companies are very volatile and may go under. And, you know, you really got to know what you're doing if you want to own something for a long time. But it's not impossible to find something and own it for a long time in that stock world. And we'll get into that. But here's what I wanted to just say is what we consider risky relative to our ancestors is such a lower bar. You know, I mean, these people went out every day to survive. I mean, they may not get through the winter. Their children might not get through the winter. And I think that they grew sort of accustomed to the level of risk, almost like a soldier does who's in combat, grows a kind of accustomed to the risk and accepts that death is potentially part of the game. And we've gotten so far away from that. You know, and perhaps it's time to move back toward a more balanced appraisal of what life's about.
I think that's really helpful, though, in investing choices. I'm not sure that's...
I think it's helpful in the sense that...
I'm not sure having a lower bar of what's risky is...
Well, here's what I wanted to say is that one of the things that I thought when I got back from Vietnam was that every day I get up, nobody's trying to kill me. And it's like you start to realize that what we think is a terrible, horrible event in your life is so not horrible or terrible. It's just an economic downturn or an economic event. So that if you were to be an investor and just the markets crash down 80% and we have this huge depression, life would be a lot less comfortable. Mm-hmm. But you're not shark fishing every day, and you're going to come home at night, and you're going to see your children grow up, and you're not in a war, and you're not attacked by, you know, dread diseases. And all of that was what was part of all of our ancestors' lives forever before the industrial age started to happen. So I think just keep it in mind. If you have a bad streak and things aren't going well, whatever part of your life things are not going well, keep a level keel, right? Keep it in mind that you're not facing death on a daily basis. And if you're not, then you're always going to be around to fight back and get up off the floor and give it another shot the next day. So that's what it teaches me when I look back at our ancestors.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. With that.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to our walk down memory lane, and maybe we'll talk about investing next week.
I think we will.
I think we will. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Time to go play. See ya. Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information or to listen to additional episodes, visit our website at investedpodcast.com and sign up for my virtual workshop right there. Spots are definitely limited for this event. I'm not kidding. They really are. They sell out very quickly. So everything discussed on this podcast, by the way, is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And it's really important, it's not to be taken as investing advice, because I am not your financial advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. So remember that. You're on your own here. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I really hope you enjoyed it.